everyone. It's Wednesday. It is hump day. It is March 11th. Kind of a beautiful day out there. You're tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Not a surprising night last night. We'll be talking a lot about that today with our guests. We have some really wonderful people. Stephen Green, we haven't talked to him in a long time. He's a professor of government at North Carolina State. And it's been months and months and months. And I finally called him because, you still remember me? I'm like, oh, God, forgive me. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Dave Leventhal from the Center for Public Integrity. And he's based in D.C., so it'll be kind of interesting to get his take on this. And he's been a reporter everywhere in Massachusetts, Texas, whatever. But we begin our show with the powerful words of Colonel Vindman. As you know, we begin our show every day that way. Oh, my God. I need to find out what the story is with Vindman. After he and his brother were perp walk out of the White House, I need to know what's happening to him. I've been Googling and can't find out. Maybe Dave Leventhal will be able to share some information, or maybe we'll send him on an assignment. Find Vindman. Here we go.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
All right, everyone. We were talking about this just before he came on the air. It's like I can't hear it enough without still being emotionally drained by this administration. And every day this administration gets more toxic. It just gets really, really crazy. You saw about the immigration judges, right? Mm-hmm. I posted this on Facebook where the immigration judges were posted a notice about the spread of COVID-19, and they were told to take it down.
Yeah.
And they were told to take – Mark Stern was out of his mind. Mark Stern was out of his mind. He wrote a piece at Slate.com. You need to read it. It's on my Facebook page. He tweeted it out, and people started challenging him. This isn't true. This isn't true. And he goes, really? I don't tweet something out that's not true. And then he wrote a whole damn article about it. Yes. God, do I love that man. Mark Stern of Slate.com, you are a god. Anyway, sir, your thoughts as we begin today's show.
Well, thanks, Arnie. I don't want to step on the rest of the show, but I do want to talk about the election. No, not the election in the United States. The elections in Israel.
They still can't come up with a government.
It's really interesting.
It's unbelievable.
I participated in a webinar yesterday with a woman named Dalia Scheindlin, who is just fabulous. She knows everything about Israel and its politics and its history and what's going on there. And it's really fascinating, the situation there, because no party, neither of the major parties, got a majority.
But it really happens anyway.
They have to always do some kind of coalition. That's why
they've
had a couple of elections already with no government forming. But now Netanyahu's trial is going to begin in a couple of weeks.
Oh, that's right. Corruption.
Trial. He's been indicted. He's on trial.
Ooh.
He's going to be the sitting prime minister on trial.
So we can do a show called Indictment Watch.
No. He's been indicted.
He's been indicted.
Trial
okay.
Watch.
Okay. Trial Watch. Okay.
Trial Watch.
Yeah. We gotta,
they're going to call witnesses.
We're going to fast forward to where we are right now.
Yeah.
Right? Trial
yeah.
Watch.
So that's pretty fascinating. It's like Donald Trump being literally in the dock in a courtroom.
Yeah.
That's what's going to be happening
over
there.
So that is permitted in Israel,
but not in
the United
States. But in Israel,
he doesn't
get removed from office.
Right.
While he's on trial. So it's going to be really interesting to watch. But then the other side of it is that his party doesn't – neither party has a majority of the Knesset, the legislature. So how's that going to happen? Well, there is a provision – I learned from Dalia Scheindlin yesterday. There is a provision in Israel that even though you don't have a majority in your coalition, 60 votes – if you have a plurality and there's a good reason to think you might be able to form a government, then that party will be asked to form a government. So Gantz, Benny Gantz, the center-left candidate against Netanyahu, he is now starting to be a little more open-minded. He's talking to the Arab List, the Joint Arab List.
Yeah, I heard. I saw an article about the Palestinians may be the ones that are the glue to hold this together. I just read that.
And he's obviously going to have to induce them to join the coalition with some recognition that Israeli government has been occupying their land and they
recognize the opportunity and the power they have in this, because I've been reading a series of articles about that.
So even with them, it's only 59-58 in favor of Gantz's coalition with the Joint Arab List, if he has them. So he would need to get some support, at least, from this guy, Avigdor Lieberman, who had been part of Netanyahu's coalition and walked out a number of years ago. And he has said in the last three elections.
And what party is he with?
He's with his own party. He formed his own party.
Okay. Does it have a name?
It does, but I can't call it at this moment. I'm sorry. But his party. He has said that he will join a coalition with the right wing, but only if Netanyahu is not the person who is prime minister. And Netanyahu says, screw you. I'm going to be the prime minister.
Why don't they just put him on hiatus? You should join our coalition.
So that's what's been going on for all these many weeks.
And so
now the question is Lieberman going to join with Benny Gantz's coalition? Lieberman said he'd never join a coalition that had the Arabs with them, the Joint Arab List party with
Netanyahu Arabs. Netanyahu Arabs. Who do you despise more? I think Netanyahu. I actually do. I think it's more personal.
Absolutely.
This is way exciting. More.
But it's really very interesting what's going on. And it's
now, where
all
is this person
that
did the webinar? Where is she based? Is she?
Well, she's in Israel.
In Israel. Okay.
Yeah, she's like 538.
She's the equivalent of that.
Knows the numbers and everything.
Right.
But she also knows the history and the politics, and she is fantastic.
Oh, my God. Well, maybe we can figure out a way
to – If I could get her on the show, I would do it. Let's figure it out.
We can maybe do it by Skype or Zoom or something like that. I mean, what's the time differential between here and Israel?
7 hours, 8 hours.
Oh, that's nothing. That's nothing. We're 12 o'clock.
We could do it. 7 hours later, right?
So they're like at 7 o'clock.
Yeah, they're at 8 o'clock at night now.
Perfect. All right. Well, let's get going. We got to get doing what's happening in what happened last night is important to understand and to sort of just talk about it. And then I actually called Bill Kerr. I had someone else who canceled, and I called Bill Kerr this morning, and he was on his way into Connecticut Public Radio, by the way, to do exactly what he's going to do with us. And my question, he said, so what do you want to talk about? I said, how about what now? Because that's exactly what I'm talking about in Connecticut Public Radio. How lucky are we? It's very, very important. So I had a question, and I was asking Carolyn before we came in, and while we're waiting to pick up our guests, let me just ask the question. Can people who recover from the coronavirus still be carriers and therefore spread it? And this is an answer from Harvard. People who get COVID-19 need to work with providers and public health authorities to determine when they are no longer contagious. See, they're not answering my question. And here is the question I'm asking. And I want people to find an answer to this. And I'm going to have to find a doctor or someone. And I keep Googling it and Googling it. If I get COVID-19, if I recover from COVID-19, everyone, I'm 66 years old, so I'm on the cusp between being really old and not being so old. I don't have any underlying conditions, so that's maybe the good news about not having any underlying conditions. So I should be okay. In fact, what did they say about the people that have been dying in Italy? I think Italy is the oldest country in Europe. I think so. I think the average age. New Hampshire is the second oldest state in the nation, by the way. Just to let you know, I think it's Vermont, Maine, and New Hampshire have the highest median age of any state in the nation. But my question is if I develop the antibodies for COVID-19, what does that mean? And I would like to know that, because if I develop the antibodies and I can't get it again, that means I can be more useful in my community if I recover from COVID-19 and I can I can, in fact, be able to assist people who may need assistance and are worried about contracting COVID-19. So I'm going to throw this out there into the ether. I want people to hear me. Can you find me an answer, a legitimate answer? And I keep doing this. If I develop COVID-19 and I recover, am I therefore immune from getting it again? And does that mean I can go into places where people need assistance who have it and not fear contracting it again so I can be of assistance? I'm kind of curious. I think in a lot of ways, you know, having it and recovering and meaning I can help people is not such a bad thing. Not that I want to get COVID-19, but I'm just sort of throwing that out there as food for thought as we sort of approach this. All right, so last night was interesting. And I mentioned this on the air before, but I'm going to grab my guests. I see we're just waiting for our second guest, and then I'll pull them both up. And the reason I think last night was interesting is that I'm surprised that Bernie Sanders didn't do this. And one of the things I learned from New Hampshire, having thought about running for the U.S. Senate, I ended up running for the House instead in 1996, was that I wanted to determine whether the person that was thinking of running in 1996, a fellow by the name of John Rao, who almost beat Judd Gregg in 1992, he almost beat him in 1992, whether John Rao, who wanted to run for the U.S. Senate, clearly had a straight shot to beat Judd Gregg again because he came so close to beating him before. And we did some exit interviews after the election of 1992 to find out about John Rao versus Judd Gregg. And let me tell you what I learned. What I learned was that nobody really wanted to vote for John Rao, or they really weren't as enthusiastic about John Rao as John assumed, that this was all about John. What they really didn't want was they really didn't want Judd Gregg. So it was more of an anti-Judd Gregg vote than it was a John Rao vote. Why am I saying this? Because I think what Bernie learned last night in places like Washington, in places like Michigan, was that it wasn't as much a Bernie Sanders vote as it was a not Hillary vote. Joining us right now on the lawn are two people who can hold my hand and sort of talk a little bit about what happened last night, give their analysis. But that's my analysis in a nutshell, that I think Bernie was somewhat shocked because he thought it was about him. And what he didn't realize was that maybe it was no Hillary and not as much yes Bernie. Joining me is, from the Center for Public Integrity, Dave Leventhal. He is the editor at large. I have known him for years. Welcome to the program, David.
Hey, Ernie, great to be back with you.
It's a pleasure. And a guy I haven't talked to in months and months and months from North Carolina State, Stephen Green, is a professor of political science. Welcome to the program, Steve.
So happy to be back with you.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. So please excuse me, Steve. I'm going to start with the guy in Washington and the guy who's sort of been massaging numbers for a long time. So your take on last night, you heard just what I said about the John Rao, Judd Gregg race, that it really was about an anti-Judd vote, not necessarily a John Rao vote. I think what Bernie suddenly realized is, especially in a one-on-one situation, that what happened in 96 was really more about unhappiness with Hillary than it was about happiness with Bernie.
Bernie Sanders, unquestionably, Ernie, not that I have to tell you or your audience, has such a passionate base of support. The people who come out to his rallies, the people who have donated $27 to his campaign
over and over again, thousands of times.
And so there's no question at all that Bernie Sanders is really had a movement. He's had a movement for years, going back to the 2016 election.
Right.
But the question with Bernie then, and the question with Bernie now, which is largely answered, is can it be expanded? Can it actually be a national movement, and can it stand up against a single candidate, not a multitude of candidates as we had during much of the Democratic Party, but a single person? And we didn't know if that would be Joe Biden. We didn't know if that would be Michael Bloomberg or Elizabeth Warren or somebody else. But now it is Joe Biden, and we see the results of that. So politics, are they fair? Of course they're not fair. This is a game of Survivor.
Yeah.
Alliances have been struck, and Bernie Sanders is on the wrong end of that equation, and he hasn't been able to break beyond the passionate base of support that he has in a way that's going to make him competitive going forward in this primary. So okay, he wins North Dakota last night. He's maybe going to eke out a victory in Washington State. But Joe Biden is gobbling up delegates. The gulf now exists between the delegates at Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders has. And barring something absolutely monumental and unexpected, and Bernie Sanders starts reeling off victories by 20, 30, 40 percentage points over Joe Biden, which would pretty much be unthinkable at this point, it's over. Joe Biden's going to be the Democratic nominee, and there's really not a whole lot that Bernie Sanders can do about it.
So, Stephen, you hang out with students, and one of the things was that they now represent potentially millennials and the group right below them, the largest potential group of voters in the United States. And what Bernie really sort of sent out as a message was not only did he have a revolution, but his revolution clearly connected with people under the age of 35 or 40, and that he would bring them out. They would be the new voters. They would represent sort of the new bench for the Democratic Party. And what was beginning in Iowa, oh, my God, where did they go? Well, I'm just trying to figure it out. And I'm just trying to understand, is it that they don't see politics or elections still as something that is important in their lives? Or do they think that the candidate they want, because they'd seen him somewhat trashed a lot on mainstream media, even if they believed in him, that he couldn't then produce a winning result? So why bother?
I mean, you know, the thing is, I think it's, to some degree, the passion was so there. But, I mean, young people have always and will always participate less in politics. It's just, it's a universal. And yes, you know, Bernie was especially popular with young people to a really impressive degree, certainly among the students I interact with every day, if I'm still allowed to as of next week. you know, it's like the truth is, and I saw this incredible passion and just this, I'm trying to think how you put an eye roll in words, but just, you know, just eye rolls constantly for Joe Biden, sort
right.
of. But, you know, the truth is that was that passionate minority. And, you know, for every student who loved Bernie, there was another student who was just like, politics. Yeah, I guess that Bernie guy's okay, but politics.
Right.
Which, you know, people get older, they get stable jobs, they live in communities, they get marriages, they get mortgages, and all these things, you know, there's this myth that this makes everybody more conservative. What it does is make you more engaged. You feel like you have more at stake, more involvement.
Right.
And
that's
a good point. I would say the good news is, right, like all these people now, you know, who have this progressive passion, in 20 years, they are going to have the families, the mortgages, the stable employment, that all these things that it's hard not to see this country moving substantially in a progressive direction. But, you know, for Bernie Sanders, it's just the time is not yet.
Well, you know, and the other thing is that so the reason I mentioned Michigan and Washington and Missouri and a lot of those other places is that, you know, because in a way he was a cult of personality, because he looked at 2016, I think, David, as kind of his progressive ideas versus Hillary. And I've said this ad nauseum on this show, and that is that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump went into the 2016 election with the highest negatives of any candidates running for president ever, that I think Pew or Gallup or whatever. Never did we so yuck and yuck as we were going into 2016. So if Bernie is running against yuck, it doesn't even matter. It's the fact that he had the guts to do it. He had a message that was clearly different from Hillary. And I think Hillary's biggest problem, and I will be honest with you, is that, you know, when she decided to leave the State Department and wait 15 months before she rolls into running for president, she raises $21 million personally for her own coffers by talking to people like Goldman Sachs. I mean, that didn't help. Let me just tell you, it didn't help. If your message is a message of change, and clearly what she looked like was kind of same old, same old. So I look at this in a lot of ways, and I guess I'm asking you, David, is that as we move forward, the other problem is that Biden was the weakest candidate in running in Iowa. He was the weakest candidate running in New Hampshire. He was the weakest candidate in Nevada. And I'm not talking about voters. I'm talking about the candidate. And the only thing that changed with weak Biden Iowa and weak Biden New Hampshire and weak Biden Nevada was Jim Clyburn. Now, unfortunately, we did not elect Jim Clyburn. We ended up electing Joe Biden. And do you think that in a lot of ways, David, that in a bizarre way, COVID-19 is the other moat around Biden? Because now he won't have to worry about big crowds. Now he won't have to interact. Because in a lot of ways, in order to keep him safe, after all, he's old and probably highly susceptible to COVID-19. But now, because of social distancing, we're told not to have these kinds of contacts, that will ultimately protect him so he can be somewhat hermetically sealed until the November election. Because, you know, he gave a beautiful speech last night, but it was written on teleprompter.
So much to unpack there, Artie. But I want to go back to, you know, just the notion of Bernie Sanders being in the race where he is right now, which I think a lot of people should find remarkable. He's an avowed Democratic socialist. He's not even a Democrat for the purposes of serving in the U.S. Senate. He's an independent, and yet he did as well as he did last presidential election cycle, and he's doing as well as he's doing being
on the other survivor,
the final two.
Right.
The other survivor. And so I think we can't, you know, have a conversation like this without at least remarking on the fact that Bernie Sanders has overperformed in significant ways. And just think back to when he announced that he was running for president again in 2020, the eye rolls, the columns that were written, people just writing him off saying, man, there's no way Bernie Sanders is going to do anything this time around.
With 24 people in the field. Exactly. With 24 people in the field. Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, if Bernie Sanders was running against fewer people, would the situation be different right now? Quite possibly. If he went into the first couple of primaries running against two or three legit candidates as opposed to six, seven, or eight, would things be different? Quite possibly. But here's something, too, and I think when you talk about the youth vote, it's contextually speaking, something you got to bore down into a little bit more. Bernie Sanders, of course, is doing incredibly well and overperforming with the youth vote writ large. But he's not performing well with the youth vote in a state like Mississippi, in a state like South Carolina, in a state like Alabama.
Right.
He's doing terribly with the black youth vote. And that's something that has hurt him across the board with young black voters, with older black voters, all black voters, and the fact that he wasn't even able to reach the 15% threshold that he needed to get some delegates in a state like Mississippi, it really just speaks to his inability to penetrate the psyche of voters who are African American. And Joe Biden, his salvation, effectively, you mentioned Jim Clyburn, but, you know, all black Americans who are voting in the Democratic primary have basically made Joe Biden or put Joe Biden in the position where he is today. And that's something that, you know, is a storyline almost to beat all other storylines in this Democratic primary.
So I have to ask the question of you, Steve, and that is, should we not have the next debate? Joe doesn't do well in debates. Not that Bernie does incredibly well. Bernie's such a curmudgeon. Oy vey. And then we got Joe, who, like, you know, after a minute and 10 seconds goes, okay, are we done with this topic? I think, doesn't the bell ring? Hasn't the bell rung? I'm looking at two people, and I'm like, is this useful for anything? I know.
I mean, and once, given that, let's be honest, right, barring something totally unforeseen, this nomination is sealed. It's hard to really see what the purpose of this debate is. I think maybe the best argument is Biden is probably going to have some debates, you know, one-on-one against Trump, and having this kind of experience hopefully will better prepare him for those. You know, I will say, you know, for all the people and you know, Biden has, as you have said, he has been, I think fair to say, the worst campaigner, maybe?
Yeah.
The worst
or
candidate.
Or at least uneven, at least, at a minimum.
For sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, but and I think that's really more that is more important in primaries where it's just so dynamic in these multi-candidate races where you can't count on partisanship to determine things. I mean, you look back at 26 people. I keep on hearing people say, well, how is Biden going to do against Trump? And it's like, do you remember Trump in debates? I mean, you know, he finishes a coherent sentence and people want to clap and say, oh, my gosh, look, Trump did a co. I mean, Trump is not great at this. And of course, he got his clock cleaned by Hillary Clinton, did not stop him winning the election. You know, so I think
Thank you. That's a good point. I needed to have my memory refreshed. I think that's absolutely true. And I'm going to go to. I've got to have grab cab before the end of this. But one of the things I've always said is, here's my rules for the debate. You ready for this? Write this down, Dave Leventhal, since you're with the Center for Public Integrity. Here are my rules for the debate. So it's Biden and it's Trump, right? And my rules are: the first person to lie, the debate ends. I freaking love it. That's my point. That's my point. And there'll be two Republicans.
I don't know if he's going to trigger it, but it'll be quick.
Right. At 2 points. Yeah, exactly. I mean, he'll say his father was from Sweden instead of Germany. I mean, come on. You know that he's been lying about everything. But the idea of saying that as the terms of the debate would be both hysterical and absolutely pointed. Absolutely. Ken, guess.
So, thank you. I just wanted to ask you both very quickly. We don't have much time left. I certainly hear you talking about the fact that it's not about the personalities, that it's not people were so supportive of Bernie either 4 years ago or now. It's more they hated Hillary and they'll hate Trump. But what about the policies? I mean, I think that it can be said that there's a pretty good portion of the Democratic Party that really feels strongly in favor of more progressive policies that Bernie and Elizabeth Warren were advocating. So whether or not they still have Bernie or Bernie is now the only standard bearer for the progressive policies, what about bringing those folks back in? They're not going to cry just because Bernie's gone, but how about because the progressive policies are gone?
All right, real quick, Dave, what about the policies?
I mean, it seems like the majority of Democratic voters really, really like the policies of Barack Obama. And Joe Biden is about as close to Barack Obama from a policy standpoint as you're going to get. So you've seen this in polls. You've seen this on the ground in various states. Joe Biden is a direct connection to those various policies that people generally like a lot on the Democratic side. And we can talk about, you know, what Joe Biden might do to bring in the more, you know, to the left policies that Bernie Sanders by and large espouses, but the core is going to be a vote for the Obama doctrine.
All right, so Steve, go on, yes.
10 seconds to just say that Biden's platform is well to the left of where
Obama's.
Hillary Clinton was, where
yes.
Obama was, because
exactly.
Bernie has moved the party left.
And I posted his speech, everyone, from last night. Do you know what he said last night? And I have to go back and make sure I read it because I heard it, which is why I posted the transcript. He said that health care is a right. I just want you to know. He said health care is a right. Those are the words of a Bernie Sanders. I just want you to know. Steve Green, we got to grab you back. Dave Leventhal, it's always good to have you on. Thank you, gentlemen, so much. Last night was interesting. We'll be doing a lot of unpacking, I'm sure. Ciao.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. All right, everyone, we're going to go to labor history. Oh, my goodness. I clicked the wrong one. Hold on, everyone. Labor history is next.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1950. That was the day 4,600 baggage handlers, mechanics, and store personnel ended their strike against American Airlines. The 11-day strike affected airports in 34 cities, crippling 80% of Americans' operations. Transport Workers Union leader Mike Quill demanded wage increases, job security, and the guarantee against subcontracting out of maintenance work. The transport workers had been locked into negotiations and mediation for months leading up to the strike at the beginning of March. In her book, On the Ground, Labor Struggle in the American Airline Industry, Liesl Miller-Ornick notes that the strike was an example of cross-skill solidarity within the union. Union baggage handlers were the first to walk out. Quill hoped to garner support by emphasizing that the planes were improperly maintained. He demanded that President Truman take over the airlines on the basis that the planes were unsafe for public transportation. Support for the strike remained strong in larger cities, but in smaller cities, strikers looked to return to work. Miller-Ornick adds, the strike victory resulted in industry firsts, a severance package for laid-off workers, and a company policy pledging only to subcontract mechanical work that American Airlines employees did not have time to do. Though they did not gain wage increases, they did win significant increases in sick leave, 3 weeks paid vacation after 12 years of service instead of 15, and paid mealtimes for night shift workers. Transport Workers Union members at Pan Am were inspired to strike over similar demands 2 months later. The victory at American spurred national mediators to hammer out a settlement in favor of Pan Am strikers only 17 hours after the strike was called. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Manufacturing is an important part of the U.S. economy, but making cars, clothing, and other goods uses a lot of energy, which creates carbon pollution. Melissa Hulting of the EPA says manufacturers often do not think about energy use beyond paying a utility bill each month.
For some of these folks, the challenge is being able to get started tracking their energy use and paying attention to it.
So to motivate manufacturers to save energy, the EPA offers the Energy Star Challenge for industry. Participating facilities measure the energy they use per square foot or unit of production, then try to reduce it by 10% within 5 years.
Whether it's through new equipment or, in a lot of cases, in fact, it can be small operational tweaks.
More than 1,000 American plants around the world have signed up, and over 500 have already met or exceeded the goal.
On average, they have almost a 20% reduction in just under 2 years.
That's good for the climate, and Hulting says it often saves money that companies can invest elsewhere.
They can hire more people, they can buy better equipment, they can start a new product line. It's making the manufacturing sector more robust.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
I looked all around me, and what do I see? Nothing but troubles and trouble and misery. Things gonna get better, just wait and see. Gotta stay by my side, darling, just you and just me. God's found a love, man, I say it's hard to find. One day, darling, you'll have some peace of mind. Things gonna get better, wait and see. Gotta stay together, darling, just you and just me.
Right. Things are going to get better. This is The Attitude with Artie Artisan and producer Ken Barnes. Who sings Things Are Going to Get Better?
Well, that's Bea Houston singing Things Are Going to Get Better, because last night, I guess, at least there's going to be
a
lot less Democratic infighting and moving on, hopefully, towards an election where Donald Trump is on his way out.
Well, I don't know if you know this, but I had called Bill Curry this morning to ask him to come on the air. And I was saying to him, like, okay, what now? And, of course, I was talking about all my angst. And he basically said, don't worry, Arnie, things are going to get better.
Oh, really?
It's exactly what you said to me. It was like, oh, my God, you didn't even know it. And it
Bill
turns
and
out,
I were born of the same of mother.
Exactly. So, Mr. Curry, I posted the transcript of Biden's speech last night on my Facebook page. I heard he delivered it incredibly well,
and best speech he's ever given that I've heard.
Thank you. And I was tears were rolling down my cheeks. I was positive. I was impressed. But then I started getting attacked. What's your agenda? Why are you posting this? What's your point? And I'm like, and I didn't. All I did was say, here is the transcript. Okay, that's all I said. And then I put, because a lot of people, I wanted them to read the words, because the words were incredible. Let me just share one thing that I just thought was so exciting. And I remember sitting up in bed going, oh, my God. And he writes, he says, I believe we're in an incredible moment in American history, a phenomenal opportunity to deliver a bold, progressive vision to the American people, guaranteeing that every American has health care, affordable health care, total health care, not a privilege, but a right.
Taking that phrase directly from Bernie was the sort of the first olive branch.
Yes, it was a bouquet. I was like, oh, thank you. Oh, thank you. I was so, so happy that he said that. But I just want to read to you one of the comments. So one of the comments on my page was, Arnie, what is the spirit in which you are posting this? This is what he wrote. So I wrote, Fred, what are you asking? He delivered it with empathy, and his words need to be read and not just heard. Why are you questioning this post? I offered no commentary like A.G. Barr. I want people to read it. If that is perceived as a negative statement, we are so screwed.
Well, let me just say, first of all, that everybody has a right not to be their very best selves in the immediate aftermath of a defeat.
Mm-hmm. I hear you.
It's hard.
I know.
I speak from experience.
We both do.
And the second thing is that I think this presents us a lot of us, progressive-minded Democrats and non-Democrats. As I said to a group I was talking to the night, I spent years criticizing Hillary for never taking responsibility for her own defeat. I don't want progressives to do the same thing. There are things that we need to change.
Yes.
This isn't all the work of an establishment conspiracy. Joe Biden is, after Donald Trump, Joe Biden may be the luckiest man in America. In many ways here. He's sort of political comfort food at a time when everyone was feeling threatened. Mm-hmm. And he had the entire media establishment and Democratic Party establishment and larger political establishment, and those establishments do all exist, and they are interconnected, making the tactical case for him and coming down harder on Bernie than I ever could have imagined. Bernie's the only person I've ever seen win presidential primaries and get more bad publicity as a result.
Yeah.
All of that's true. Mm-hmm. It's also true that the fiscal bidding war between Bernie and Warren didn't speak to many people outside our core base. Progressivism and populism were always more about changing the rules than spending money. Mm-hmm. And that's the core of their radicalism. And we weren't good at illustrating things, and the proposals were new and complex and hard to explain, but we didn't do a very good job either. Democrats generally don't, but progressives, we're the people who have new ideas, and new ideas by their very nature require more illustration and explanation. Mm-hmm. And we didn't do a good job of providing it. And so those are all things. It's not a question now. I mean, I do believe that the race has been functionally decided in terms of the nomination. I don't think for a minute that means Bernie should get out. I do think that the tone with which we proceed, and I say this with regard for the well-being and strength of the progressive movement, as well as for that of the party and the country. I've always said that when you see fascism being born, your first duty is to kill it in its crib.
Right.
And the point here now really is to make sure we win this election and, if at all possible, bring a Democratic Senate in along with it. At the same time, that does not mean that the pressure for change within this party, within this country, is going to go away. And I'll just add one thing about that and then give it up here. And that is, Obama got a free pass that he never should have gotten, including from the entire institutional left in Washington, labor, environmental, women's groups, human rights groups. And when he didn't raise the minimum wage, when he didn't bail out the homeowners, only the banks, when he dropped the public option, when he didn't do any of the anti-corruption measures that had been the heart and soul of his general election stump speech, I'll stop there. I could go on a lot longer. The silence on the left was extraordinary.
Exactly.
And that's not going to happen for Joe Biden. One, because lots of people have learned the lesson. Two, because Biden isn't someone in which we've all invested such hopes, except the hope of getting rid of Trump.
Yeah.
And he doesn't have the natural charisma or stature or political skills. And there's a whole new group come, Ocasio-Cortez, and all kinds of other grassroots stuff going on here. And so I think that the debate we're going to continue to have will be nothing like what we saw in the Obama administration.
Well, and the other reason is that, let's go back to 2008. 2008 was an economic meltdown created by Wall Street. Wall Street, because of its money, its lobbyists, its control, its revolving doors, it was able to basically, be able to restore itself despite the fact that it was the cause of the economic meltdown. But it was about economics, and there was a way to trigger
you know, a way of repairing it, not necessarily for Main Street, but definitely for Wall Street. Am I wrong?
It's also, by the way, the direct money they put into the Obama campaign.
Oh, absolutely.
Even the rest of the Democratic Party was ready to go further, and certainly our base was, and the American people wanted him to go a lot further.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, he promised to investigate and prosecute all of the people who committed fraud on Wall Street. We didn't do any, et cetera, et cetera,
et cetera. Right, right. No, you're on. So let's look at, so that was his charge. The charge with Joe Biden is going to be interesting because, one, the first charge is replacing the authoritarian in chief. And clearly that's what the message is. And I'm not sure people are embracing Joe Biden as much as they're basically saying we must remove Donald Trump. That is the first charge. But because of COVID-19 and because of what Donald Trump has done with deregulation and exploding the deficit and giving huge tax breaks to people that were already ridiculously wealthy, what that has done now, and especially COVID-19, it has shown every single weakness in our economic system. It has shown the weakness in our public health. It has shown the weakness in our economic policies. It's shown the weakness in our labor policies. It's shown the weakness in our healthcare system. All the things are going to be exasperated. I mean, that didn't happen after the economic meltdown. It did happen as a result of COVID-19. And it's everything you've been talking about, Bill Curry, Arne Arnesen has been talking about, and to a large extent, Bernie has been talking about, but people didn't necessarily connect it with necessarily the failure of the United States. Well, guess what? By not responding to those economic policies, by not responding to those healthcare policies, by not giving people paid leave, sick leave, you know, universal healthcare that isn't related to a job, creating a public health system, investing in infrastructure, not giving rich people more money than they need and investing it in our future, all those things are now front and center when Joe Biden wins this race for president. It is not a back burner, and you're absolutely right. He's not Barack Obama. We don't have to protect him because he's the first black president. We have to make sure that he actually does what he said in that speech last night.
Yes, I think, and that's always, I've said for a long time, I'm a radical. I'm so radical that I want the Democrats to do the following. Run on Obama's 2008 platform,
yes,
but this time really mean it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, universal health care, corruption, living wage, climate change, all the things that were in there that they then forgot when they got into office.
Right.
And I also think that for all of us, if we try to wrap together the various strands of our lives and feel all the kinds of changes we've gone through, so many of us have been trying to learn spiritual development, emotional maturity. We've been looking for alternatives, not just to our political system, but to lots of other institutions. And I do believe, again, that the media, the people I watch on cable television, deeply frustrate me. They hear Bernie shouting about billionaires, but don't hear Biden shouting at voters. They're very selective in how all this stuff has gone. But there is a thing here. We have to model both Biden. One of the things that made Biden's speech so good last night was he stopped shouting.
He did.
And he expressed empathy.
He did.
And he was more himself.
He did.
Also, because he was reading from a teleprompter. I think this will be a campaign in which both parties try to keep their nominees quarantined, and not just because they're in a high-risk demographic. They're going to try to keep them on message and borderline out of sight.
Yeah.
Because, you know, each one has a capacity of blowing himself up. But having said this, I say this to Biden and I say it to the left. There is nothing soft about being civil, mature, reasoned, humane, and empathetic.
Thank you.
And these are things that every leader that I've most admired, and Gandhi and Nelson Mandela and Vaclav Havel and Martin Luther King, so many leaders have embodied that, teaching morality by example, not by lecturing people on their deficiencies. How we approach cultural issues, how we model and teach cultural change, and how we approach the basic social contract that we want to establish and enforce. We have some rethinking to do. I'll just add one thing about that, and that is, as we go forward, one of the things that's always frustrated me about my allies is that every time we have a meeting about what to do, everything we could possibly do ends up on the agenda. We are very bad at prioritizing, which makes us not so good at communicating either. we have to decide where the compromises need to be made. I'll repeat this again. There's no need to compromise with the fossil fuel industry or the pharmaceutical or insurance or defense industries. Mm-hmm. We need to compromise with the voters, and we need to prioritize what we need in order to hold the party accountable. I would suggest, one, living wage, because once you start insisting on it, it's hard for them to duck it, and we desperately need it. Two, I'm actually not so worried about taxes. The entire party is going to be for raising taxes to a large degree. We'll see where the fights may be. But I think a substantial increase in taxes on wealth and high income and a real living wage with an inflation adjuster could be the most massive redistribution of income in the history of the United States. Lastly, I just want to say there are two issues, corruption and climate, under which no compromise should be brooked or tolerated. Mm-hmm. And I think that is, you know, there are lots of things to do and lots of things we can get done and lots of things we can collaborate on. But knowing where the problems will be, I forgot to add health care, and figuring out a compompromise between Biden's public option and Bernie's Medicare for All.
You've already got it. You've talked about it so often.
That gets us to universality and cost containment. That ought to be a public discussion now.
Yeah.
We ought to fight hard, civilly, maturely, in a reasoned and empathic and supportive way between now and November 3rd. But we ought to continue to fight for the issues. I said the question for Bernie isn't whether to get out or stay in, but it is to some degree about tone, whether it's continue to be as combative.
Oh.
What we need to do is illustrate and explain and teach our positions.
Oh my God! So you mentioned
and staying in and debating those in that tone, that would be good for everyone and good for us and prepare us well for the battles that are beginning the day this monster's been removed.
So before I toss to Ken, yesterday, as I was walking out of the studio, I said, I want Václav Havel to be in the head of Bernie Sanders. And the reason I said I want, remember, it was the Velvet Revolution.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the word is velvet, not revolution. And what Bernie doesn't have the capacity to do, which is why I didn't want him to run. Not because his ideas aren't phenomenal, and not because they're not exactly what I would want for my country. It is that he doesn't have that tone down. He doesn't have that empathy down. He doesn't have that softness down. I don't want him to soften his ideas. His ideas are good ideas. But as I was walking out yesterday, all I kept thinking about was the Velvet Revolution. And what he has never had the capacity to do was to understand that. And when you look at people like Martin Luther King, and you look at people like Gandhi, and you look at people like Václav Havel, as you just mentioned before, there was a gentleness even as there was an embrace of change. And that is something that Bernie does not have the capacity to do. And you said you want him to stay in this race. Here's my question to you. Can he figure that out so he can move these ideas forward without getting more and more people to sort of back away from him? That's my concern.
Let me just say, what I actually said was that I don't think the issue is so much whether he stays in and gets or gets out, but whether he, A, can do a better job of explaining the ideas that we believe in, right, and B, do it in a tone that attracts voters. And, you know, again, I always tell people, read Martin Luther King's letter from the Birmingham jail.
Yeah.
We read
Gandhi.
Yeah.
Read Gandhi in that famous exchange with the judge in that colonial court.
Right.
Read Mandela on the subject of de Klerk.
Yeah.
These people never said a negative thing about their opponents, and their opponents were their jailers.
Right.
And yet at the same time, nobody ever accused any one of them of being soft or ambiguous,
exactly,
of not fighting fiercely enough.
Exactly.
There's no contradiction here. You could do both. We have to. That's the age. That's what this age demands of us.
Well, and Arnie said she was going to toss to me, and this is really where I was going to go, Bill, is the question of Bernie staying in the debate and even keeping it as being called a debate about a nomination may be the problematic thing. I mean, it would be much better to have somebody like Elizabeth Warren explaining the progressive policies in a more reasoned and factual-based and toned-down rhetoric. And actually, in the debates, she didn't do it as well as she did in the non-debates, like after the debates were over, and she sits in the studio talking to people more laid back.
Well,
she
was,
that kind of conversation was really powerful, and she was not didactic, not pedagogical, as some people have accused her of being in the debates. But in terms of toning down the rhetoric, having Bernie up there as the foil for Biden just doesn't seem like it can work. And maybe they can invite brainstorming among the Democratic leaders.
I see it slightly. I see a lot of what you're saying and agree with a lot of what you're saying. I see it slightly differently. Again, I see the challenge for Bernie being tone, and I see the challenge for all of us. You know, the problem with the progressive positions is not extremism.
Exactly. Right.
The problem is rigidity. Yep. And the problem is the inability to make some key choices. And I agree that Warren is usually better at those things. All Democrats are really bad at it. For a variety of reasons.
Except
Bill Clinton. For all of his other faults, the one thing he was really, really good at was taking complex ideas and translated them into understandable formulations. We should all be. There was a point where Obama said Clinton was his splainer in chief, and I remember thinking, "No, Barack, that's your job."
But
we all have to get better at it. And there's a case to be made. If you're the party of new ideas, if we're the movement of new ideas, that means that our ideas require a little more explaining precisely because they're new.
So let me just say something. I've been listening to AOC recently, not through the fact that she's part of the squad, but just listening to her. There is a softness about her.
I think she's very – there's a shrewdness about her, too.
A shrewdness, exactly. And I was thinking – and I was listening to her. I mean, she's the one, for example, who said, if we don't get Medicare for all, then, well, the fallback is public option. And she didn't say – she kind of said a little bit defeatist, but in a lot of ways. But what an improvement. Do you know what I mean? So she was able to sort of bridge what Bernie is saying in that rigid way. And AOC was saying, but by pushing us that far, if the compromise ends up being this, we're still so much better off. And look at that. That's the compromise, not losing public option. You know, and I just see her, and I watched her when she questions people during congressional hearings. She is shrewd, but she's smart. And she doesn't sound shrieky. And she doesn't sound like she's right and they're wrong. But she frames it in such a way that they step in it. You know, I mean, I kind of love it. And I think she has a little bit of that tonal sense that you're talking about.
Yeah, I agree. Of all the people, you know, it's interesting. I wouldn't be surprised after this election if a whole group of people in their 50s, whom I've never, you know, I haven't been that interested in, a lot of the people who are candidates in this election, who really grew up at a time when they came to believe that pay-to-play politics was the only road ahead. What I saw on the stage was an awful lot of decent. I'm here to say I'm morally better than they are, but boy, did they believe in the pay-to-play system. Kamala Harris, Booker Buttigieg for sure. And I see in the generation behind them all kinds of people, and of the people I see coming up, she so far is the one who most impresses me. But, you know, I'm looking to that next cohort.
Right.
To take some of these things in consideration, and that we've been talking about this morning, and I feel like I see it happening.
So I'm going to ask you a question that I got a knuckle sandwich. James Carville was on the other night, and I'm listening to him, and he says, "Let's end it now. No more debates. No more anything. It's over. He's a nominee." Now, one of the things I said was, I understand why James Carville is saying this, because we have seen people rise and fall during debates. We saw Amy Klobuchar rise. We saw Kamala Harris rise for a moment. But now there's only two people on the stage, Bernie and Biden. And I don't – and you mentioned about him being hermetically sealed between now and 2020. And the idea is, in a lot of ways, COVID-19 is a phenomenal excuse for making sure that he doesn't necessarily have to engage on a lot of levels that there would be an expectation of candidates doing. But I'm trying to figure out, is there value in this next debate – other than it might hurt Biden? And is that what we want? Because in the end, Biden will be part of a team, and what we need him to do is defeat Donald Trump.
Well, let me just remind people a couple of things about Bernie that are very positive to me. One, people who really have eyes to see and ears to hear know that he has been vastly more civil to his opponents than they have been to him.
Yes.
That there hasn't been more comment about this, or hardly any really, stuns me. You know, but it's another question. And I don't doubt for a moment his ability to have this discussion in a very different way. I think that Bernie could do his version in a debate of what Biden did last night. That would be a moment in the history of the Democratic Party worth savoring.
It
would only strengthen us. So again, to me, it's up to Bernie. James Carville is a horse's ass in so many ways. There's no way around it.
No, I totally agree.
He's just a horse's ass. And all the Democrats who've been dancing on Bernie's grave and then turn around and say we have to unite the party should be ashamed of themselves. Mm-hmm. But there's a chance here to have a discussion which is no less fierce for being civil and factual and reasoned.
And
respectful.
Right. And one of the things I would want Bernie to do on the debate on Sunday night is to actually compliment Joe on that speech he gave last night.
Yeah, it would be
incredible because it would start out by saying that was beautiful, and
he might do it again. We'll see. It's hard. It's hard when we're reeling to be our best selves. We all know this. I hope he could do this. If it's not going to be that kind of tone, then I also hope I'm not. I don't think anybody should be telling Bernie Sanders when to get in or get out. And I believe that he's a giant in our politics. You've heard me say this before in the show. Three people altered the course of political debate in my country in my lifetime. Ronald Reagan, Donald Trump, and Bernie Sanders. And Bernie's the only one who altered it for the better.
And on that note, I need to let you go. You alter my show for the better. So thank you so much for joining us, Bill.
Take it.
All right.
I'll talk to you guys soon.
All right, ciao. Bye-bye. All right, we end with...
We end with A Change Is Gonna Come by the Neville Brothers, which is...
Totally appropriate.
Hoping that it'll be a change for the better.
Oh, Bernie, listen to Bill. Bernie, listen to Bill.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Just like the river I've been running ever since. Oh, it's been a long, long time coming, but I know change gonna come.